And one thing you need to do in going to this is you need to RSVP to where it says RSVP on here, because the folks who run this need to know you're coming. With that said, just a basic overview of the committee rules. Members, we will not be voting on these. These are the chair's rules. But it does give you kind of a notice and heads up about how we're going to be proceeding. And I just need to find mine. But take out your rules. Just some basic highlights. If you're not going to be here, make sure that your LA notifies my CLA, Letitia Townsend, right there, who's passing out the folders. Committee will start promptly at 9:45 for every committee hearing, so please be here on time. I think almost everyone's here on time. And historically, whether Chair Scott ran this committee or whether I ran this committee under its previous incarnation, the Republicans were always here on time, and we had one or two DFLers, and then they slowly trickled in, if at all, over the course of the committee hearing. So DFLers, I'm going to be watching you, making sure you're here on time, because we're in the majority. We need to vote. That was kind of a joke, but nobody's laughing. It was also happened to be true. Second, during the hearing, all presentations and discussions will go through the chair. I as chair, will determine the time of debates, witnesses, and times for bills. And if you want a hearing on a bill in this committee, you have to submit a hearing request, okay, because my CA, Rachel Ganani, needs to set up the amount of time that you're going to need. She needs to know who you're going to be having as witnesses, how much time it's going to take, and how much Q&A. So you need to submit a hearing request, because just an email saying, hey, I want a hearing on House File 1160, doesn't tell her anything about what she needs to do to plan for it. So please submit a hearing request, which will include all of that stuff. Substantive amendments are to be received by Rachel, the CA, Ms. Ganani, in writing by 10 a.m. the prior day, and amendments to amendments are, well, I don't see it in the highlights, but we've got another rule on amendments to amendments. It's like thereafter, 5 p.m. Yeah, it's kind of like on the floor, but we have static times, not fluctuating times based upon the time of session. So let me see here. The next exemptions. Oh, if it's a non-substantive oral amendment that everyone can get and no one's like, wow, what does this do? Then at my discretion, I'll allow the amendment. But I'm going to default to having them prepared and drafted by House Research so that we don't screw up on that. Next. Oh, yeah, to ensure proper format. So, well, you can divide amendments, but I'll determine if it's divisible and I decide what portion it gets voted on first. And then have your presenters or testifiers let us know if they're going to need the AV equipment, like this fun little We the People stuff on the screens, right? That needs to be set up ahead of time. Also, this is a rule for me, and Chair Scott has known this for years, that no one comes in the curtilage of the committee before or after committee. So you know how when we adjourn and lobbyists rush up to the table in front of you while you're trying to get your stuff together? No, it's not going to happen. If you're a member of the public or a lobbyist and you want to meet with a member, you can wait for them in the public areas of the hearing room, and you can have those discussions before or after committee, but not while folks are trying to get their stuff together and maybe rush off to their next thing, because or you can make an appointment with their LA, but no one past the testifiers table unless you are a committee member or staff. And then if you need to talk to a member during committee, please take it either outside or up to that little alcove where it doesn't disturb the committee proceedings. That said, any questions? Representative Johnson.
Chair Lesh, I was wondering if we're going to get the amended rules with
the correct room,
Section 2, taken care of?
We are. We amended it, and we posted the correct room, that it's room 10, and that will be up there. So,
thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Any other questions? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to be here. I noticed that this is sort of an unwritten rule, but I noticed there are a lot of freshmen on this committee, and are they apprised of the freshman rule if they have a bill before this committee?
Oh.
That you might want to enlighten them.
Well, I mean, I think part of the fun about having an unwritten rule is that they don't know about it, and they have to find out the hard way. But, yes, that's fair. If you are a freshman on this committee, and you are presenting a bill for the first time, you're obligated to bring treats for the committee.
And they can't be healthy.
No healthy snacks.
No quinoa or anything.
Yeah, we don't want quinoa or arugula or the other stuff that my wife likes to eat. Okay, and before we begin, members, we're going to do, are we on time, by the way?
Yes.
Okay. 9:50. Yeah, pretty close to it. We're going to do introductions of committee members next time because we're going to give the corpus of our time to the public defenders to present here for the kind of agency presentation. But before we begin, and we're going to have House Research and other folks introduce themselves next time as well because Mr. Walls is not here today. But I will be introducing my CLA, Letitia Townsend, who hails from Minneapolis. And she runs a tight ship. So she's the point person for all matters or scheduling on the committee, et cetera. And do you want to say a little bit about yourself, Letitia? I didn't tell you you were going to have to do this today.
No.
Just say where you went to school or something.
Okay, well, I just graduated from Mankato in May. I was a communications major. I'm new to politics. I'm new to government. So if I mix up anything or if there's anything you'd like in your folders, let me know and I'll fix it.
Excellent. Thank you, Letitia. And Rachel Ganani is the committee administrator.
Yes.
You want to say?
I'm the committee administrator. I'm an attorney by trade, by school, I guess. Practiced for 9 years, civil law. And I'm from Minnesota, lived in New York for 12 years. That's where I practiced, moved back a year and a half ago, and I'm really excited to be here. So
you got a New York attorney as the CA, so y'all can just
watch out.
Okay. Yeah, she's from Minnesota, but she hasn't shaken off the New York vibe yet, which I prefer, actually. I like. That said, no other questions from members. And like I said, we'll do some of the other issues, and Chair Scott will give you an opportunity to weigh in on some stuff next time, too. And then we'll do introductions next time. But that said, we have with us, members, the state public defender. And one of the things that a lot of these committees do, as freshmen may not be familiar, is we'll do departmental overviews. The public defenders are one of the agencies that fall under this committee budget, and you'll have to be making a decision about funding them and the portions of their budget when we do markup at third deadline in this committee. So with that, we have two testifiers at the table. On behalf of the public defenders, please introduce yourselves.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the chief administrator with the Board of
Defense. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Bill Ward. I'm the state public defender.
Mr. Chairman and members, we have a slideshow. You should have in your packet a paper copy of all of this so that you can follow along. First of all, thank you for the opportunity to come and do the overview. I know you have a lot of new members and new members to the committee as well. We will try to cover as much as we can. We will be around. We've met with a few of you already, and we will be around to meet with you individually, talk about any questions or issues that come up, and we will obviously be available. So, Chairman and members, our federal and state constitutions both provide that anyone charged with an offense that's punishable by a loss of liberty is entitled to representation by a lawyer. That's the Gideon versus Wainwright decision, which I know a number of you have seen. Our Minnesota statutes also provide that certain parties have a right to counsel. In the Gideon decision, the U.S. Supreme Court indicated that both governments, both federal and state, properly spend vast sums of money to establish machinery to try defendants accused of crimes. That was the basis of their majority decision in that case. And the indication was that defendants, based on the work and the money that government is spending to prosecute, that lawyers for clients or lawyers for those accused are necessities, not luxuries. In the state of Minnesota, the Board of Public Defense is the entity that's charged with representing folks that are accused of crimes. Our agency is a judicial branch agency. It's made up of 7 volunteer members, 4 lawyers appointed by the Supreme Court, 3 non-lawyers that are appointed by the governor. These folks put in an inordinate amount of time, and again, they're volunteers. They're taking time away from their private practice or their work to serve. They get the $55 per day per diem or meeting per diem and mileage. That's their compensation for putting in the hours. The board traditionally meets monthly, although there are times of the year, particularly during the legislative session, where we don't quite make the monthly meetings just because there's just too many other things going on. The duties of the board. The board sets the standards and policies for the public defender system. It appoints our district chief public defenders. We have a district chief public defender in each judicial district. They appoint the chief appellate defender. They also appoint the state public defender. And their biggest job, or their most important job, if you will, is allocation of the funding that we get from the legislature. Organizationally, we are organized into 3 programs. We have our district public defense. Those are the folks that deal with the district defense trial level. The appellate office, which handles all of the appeals, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a while. And our administrative services office. The other piece that we have are the public defense corporations. There are 4 nonprofit corporations that provide public defense services and around the state. We will talk a little bit about that as we go along also. The board in 2011 went through a retreat process and developed 5 major goals that kind of guide their decision making, guide all of the work that public defenders do. Continual training for all staff, creative advocacy, client-centered representation, which is probably the biggest one, being a full partner in the justice system, and the recruitment and retention of excellent staff. Being a full partner in the justice system, we have been very cognizant of and participating in a number of either Supreme Court task forces. We have a representative on the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. There are a number of those kinds of entities that our folks have been involved in over the years. On the district public defense level, we provide constitutionally mandated services in felony cases, gross misdemeanor, and other cases, the other being things like probation violations and extradition cases. Misdemeanor cases, and juvenile delinquency. Statutorily, we're also mandated to represent children 10 years of age and older in child protection cases. You will be hearing more about this issue as we go along in the session, not only from us, but I'm sure you've probably heard it from your counties, the prosecutors, and human services. This has been a growing area of concern, not only for us, but to everybody that's involved in those cases. On the appellate side, the office provides constitutionally mandated services in criminal appeals. Those are direct appeals of tried cases. Post-conviction proceedings in the district court, things like review of guilty pleas, review of evidence, sentencing accuracy, those kinds of issues. And supervised release proceedings, what we used to call parole revocation hearings. Our folks travel all over the state to do those hearings as well. I mentioned the public defense corporations. The corporations have statutorily mandated funding under 611.215. The state started funding these programs in the early 1980s. They originally started with some federal funding and some local dollars, some nonprofit dollars. When there were federal budget cuts in the early 1980s, the state stepped in to fund these corporations. The corporations handle roughly 3,300 cases a year that otherwise would be public defender cases. As you can see, they're the Minneapolis Legal Rights Center, the Neighborhood Justice Center in St. Paul, Duluth Indian Legal Services in Duluth, and the Regional Native Public Defense Corporation, which provides services on the White Earth and Leech Lake reservations.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Chair Scott.
Yes, thank you. I had a question on that. What's the budget for the public defense corporations, if you know that?
Go ahead,
Chairman and members, the corporations receive about $1.6 million per year.
Thank you.
Mr. Kyers, so that's collectively $1.6 million across? Okay, thank you. I got the nod from Mr. Ward on that. $1.6 million for all four of them?
All four, Mr. Chairman, yes.
Got it.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, so you see the map with the 10 judicial districts. We have 9 district offices. We combined the 7th and 8th judicial districts administratively a few years ago. We also have 17 satellite offices. Those are the ones indicated with the blue triangles. And then we have 180 part-time public defenders as well that provide service. And we'll talk a little bit more about those as we go along here. The board's budget, which obviously is of interest to all of you on this committee, it's roughly $88 million a year. You can see the split here. Over 90% of it is district public defense, roughly 7% in our appellate office, and about 3% in our administrative services office. We run the entire operation with 12 people in our office, 7 of whom are tech staff. So when you see Mr. Ward and I here, you've got 40% of the staff is away from the office. Luckily, it's the 40% that doesn't do the work that the other 60% actually do. So budget by item. 90% of the budget is personnel. I don't think that's anything surprising to any of you that have sat on any of the budget committees before. About 6% of the budget is what we call mandated costs. Those are things that we are obligated either by contract or by collective bargaining agreement to pay. Things like rent, data lines, phone lines. One of our biggest ones is mileage. We pay, obviously, folks to go back and forth to the courthouses. The 9th district alone, which is that northwestern quadrant of the state, from basically from Brainerd straight across to the Dakotas and then north to Lake of the Woods, those folks drive anywhere between about 75 and 95,000 miles a year. It is a tremendous burden on them. And obviously, as you can see, a tremendous cost to the agency. Staffing-wise, we have roughly 780 staff. 536 of those are assistant public defenders. About 35% of our assistant public defenders are part-time, as I mentioned. If you get outside of Hennepin and Ramsey counties, about 45% of the assistant public defenders are part-time. The 780 total also includes county employees in Hennepin and Ramsey County. We're going to talk a little bit more about this when we get to the budget piece, but roughly 20 years ago, the state assumed the cost of public defense or completed the state assumption of public defense from the counties and grandfathered in the county employees in Hennepin and Ramsey. So we, in those two districts or those two offices, we have a combination of both state employees and county employees. Those folks, obviously, as they retire, we replace them with state employees. So those numbers are going down. But each of those offices still have a significant number of county employees in them. The other professional staff that we have, you see our attorneys, but also we have paralegals, investigators, our legal secretaries and assistants, and also our dispositional advisors or our sentencing advocates. These groups, the attorneys, are in one bargaining unit represented by Teamsters Local 320, and our support staff is in a second bargaining unit. I mentioned earlier our part-time defenders. These are really the backbone of our system outside of the metro area, or particularly outside of Hennepin and Ramsey counties. Frankly, we couldn't do the work we're doing without them. They are state employees. They are part-time. They're either 75%, 50% time, or 25% time. That's a bit of a misnomer because they put in about between 25 and 40,000 extra hours a year that they don't get paid for. They agree to take whatever cases they're assigned to or whatever courtroom they're assigned to, they take those cases. They're paid on a biweekly basis, just like our state regular state employees are. They're paid on a lump sum basis. And they cover their own office head. The only thing we do is we do provide a small stipend for them every year. They have a $4,800 if you are a 75% time defender, $3,600 if you're a 50% time defender. Those of you who are lawyers on the committee know it costs a lot more than that to run a law office. Our estimates and the things that we've heard from the private bar is that anywhere from maybe 40 to 50% of a retainer or of what they're paid actually goes to office overhead. So you see the $4,800 is not a lot of money, relatively speaking. We are the largest user of the court system. We have roughly 150,000 cases a year on the trial level, about 4,700 appellate files that are opened, about 4,700 supervised release, so those parole revocation hearings. We provide mandated services in every county, in every courtroom. The key factor here is that caseloads and workloads are controlled by outside factors. Eligibility for public defender services is determined by the court. We take who's ever eligible or determined to be eligible. The other thing is public defenders cannot refuse cases. We have two state Supreme Court decisions that indicate that we are not able to refuse cases. Those of you who have been around here and heard our presentation before, you've heard me say this before, is if we have 20 potholes between Minneapolis and St. Paul on I-94, and the Department of Transportation can only get to 10 of those, or they only have money to fill 15 of those, we swerve around the other five. We don't have that luxury. When our defenders have 15 or 20 clients waiting in the courtroom hallway to meet them and to handle their case, they can't say, I'm going to take the first 15 of you and the rest of you have to come back tomorrow. Again, we don't have that luxury. When you combine that with the fact that 90% of the budget is personnel, you can see some of the issues, and again, this isn't a budget hearing, but you can see some of the issues that start to develop for us.
We have a question from Representative. Go ahead, Representative.
I just had a quick question. For those of us who are not familiar with this process, I know you mentioned that if people are eligible for this, are you going to be going over who is eligible, and if not, is there any way we could get information so that we know what demographic or population is eligible for this?
Mr. Carr.
Mr. Chair, we put out guidelines for the courts. We're required to do that every year. Each county is a little bit different as to how they are applied. Ultimately, it's poverty, being above the poverty line or below the poverty line. It's pretty rare that we are appointed cases that are people are not eligible, and that's really not an issue outstate or in the metro area at all. The issue becomes in some of the districts as to whether or not there's some sort of reimbursement based upon a borderline eligibility. And obviously, it also depends, Mr. Chair and members, as to whether or not they're felony cases, gross misdemeanor cases, or misdemeanor cases as to eligibility for our office.
Thank you. Representative Herb, sir.
Just a follow-up question. So if I wanted to know, say I live in Ramsey County and I want to know, is there somewhere I can go to actually find that information so that I'm familiar with at least Ramsey County?
Sure. Mr. Ward, it is actually in the statute, and I can provide that to you.
Hey, could you just restate, Mr. Kyer, Mr. Ward, what percentage of criminal defendants are public defender eligible in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman and the members, a great question. I should have covered it. Felonies and gross misdemeanors, 85% to 90% are public defender clients. When you get to misdemeanors, it's probably 60-65%. When you get to the misdemeanors, things like DWI, those types of things, there tends to be more private involvement there, the private bar. So that's why the numbers go a little lower.
And, Mr. Chair, in juvenile cases, we probably have over 90% of the juvenile delinquency petitions that are filed.
Okay. And one other quick question. If you know this, what percentage of the cases filed in Minnesota are criminal versus civil?
Chair, I suspect that the courts would know that better.
If you know, of course, my recollection is somewhere between two-thirds to three-quarters are criminal. Granted, civil cases oftentimes take more time, but Representative Hurley, that gives you a little bit better idea that these folks here are handling the vast majority of cases that come through Minnesota courts in whatever form. Representative Considine, did you have a question?
Actually, just a quick procedural one. I ran and got a cup of coffee, so I did walk in late. You may have covered this. How do you want to handle questions during?
Oh, we didn't cover it, and really comes down to the time, because members, we're going to be out of here in 30 minutes, and we're on page 9 of
19.
I will.
Page 19.
It goes a little quicker, Mr.
So that, does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Don't ask any?
No. I don't know. You can, but, we'll clip through it. Go ahead, John.
Mr. Chairman and members, on the next slide, it's also important to note that public defenders are held to the same ethical standards as any other attorney, any private attorney is. You can see here a couple of the United States Supreme Court decisions regarding effective assistance of counsel in plea negotiations and in immigration consequences. So, again, we have a situation where we can't refuse cases, but we also, our folks are held to the same ethical standards that any private lawyer is, which again sets up a somewhat difficult situation at times. So.
Mr. Chair, if I can also butt in here, I can't stress how important this is. We should be held to the same ethical standard. That's a given. But the Lafler and Cooper cases or Fry cases are so absolutely important. When you think about, Mr. Kyer mentioned 150,000 cases a year. We have 44 investigators for 150,000 cases a year. Yet we have to investigate each and every one of those cases to the best of our ability. We have to advise our clients based upon our reading of the discovery and the investigations of the case. At the same time, we're getting pressure on moving cases through the system. That becomes an issue. Our ethical responsibilities are paramount to our clients, but we have limited resources to do the best we can based upon the parameters set forth by our funding.
Thank you.
So, Chairman, on the next slide, you can see what are the breakdown of cases by case type. You can see the misdemeanors are obviously the biggest case type that we handle. But we do have a workload system that we've developed, and this really kind of goes to more of what Mr. Ward has talked about, which is, the workload or the time that it takes to resolve cases. We break down the caseloads into a case unit, roughly the equivalent of a misdemeanor. These standards that the board adopted are from 1991. So you can imagine how much more complicated the job that you have behind this table is, the job that you have in your other world is, and how much more complicated the practice of law is since 1991. So this standard says that a lawyer should handle 150 felony cases a year or 400 misdemeanor cases a year. If you're handling 150 felony cases a year, when you figure in vacation time, holidays, training time, you're looking at roughly 12 to 14 hours spent on a felony case. On a misdemeanor case, 4 to 5 hours. I don't know that if you would go to a private attorney and they'd say, well, I can take your case, but, you know, I only can spend about 4 hours on it. I don't know that you'd hire that lawyer or you'd have much confidence in that lawyer. That's the standard, that roughly that 400 case unit. Our lawyers right now are about right around 600 case units that they carry. So you can see some, again, as Mr. Ward indicates, some of the pressures that they're under, both ethically and time-wise. On the appellate level, we have some of the same issues. You can see the increase in the number of cases over the last 3 years. The parole revocations are directly related to the number of folks that we are sending to prison. The appellate files, again, the same thing. The workloads and our caseloads. Again, I mentioned the eligibility is determined by the court. Back in 2010, the legislative auditor did a review of the public defender system and indicated that the high public defender workloads have created significant challenges for Minnesota's criminal justice system. You might imagine that given what we've talked about and in terms of the numbers of cases or the percentage of cases that our folks represent, if we've got a problem, if we've got an issue, we're not available somewhere, if we've got too many cases, the entire system grinds to a halt. Some of the workload factors, the increased use of scientific evidence, be it forensics, be it DNA, computer analysis, all of these things that, again, when those standards were developed in 1991, nobody had any indication that, that those things would be important or those things would be coming along. DNA evidence, again, old cases, cold cases, the expanded use of them. We're now seeing them quite a bit on property crimes as opposed to just the personal crimes that we saw before. We're not here to tell you that you shouldn't be using it. We're not here to tell you it's a bad thing. I think what we're here to tell you is that there are two sides to this. And when one side of the equation starts to have these kinds of resources or this kind of scientific evidence developed, we're the other side. We have to have those things analyzed. We have to have it looked at. If you remember a few years ago the problems that the St. Paul Crime Lab encountered, that was the direct result of a couple of our public defenders taking a look at this and being able to hire an expert, frankly, that assisted them in looking at that and finding those problems. And this is one that's only growing. I think you've all heard of it. There's now a tri-county lab up in Anoka, Wright, and Sherburne counties. They have four forensic scientists and a $1.7 million budget. Our annual budget for expert witnesses statewide is $400,000. Maybe?
Tops.
At the top. And that includes money that we have for interpreters and transcript costs as well. So,
and Mr. Chair and members, if I could, when we use St. Paul as an example, it's not to chide St. Paul. The sad thing is how long did that go on before we were actually able to determine that there was an issue? And how many people's cases were, they were convicted, they were in prison, they were put on probation based upon our inability to tackle that issue at the times that we should have done that. So that's shame on us. We're very proud of what we did, but it took that long for us to figure it out. And in this day and age, right now we're talking about transfer DNA, we're talking about mixtures on DNA, we're talking about testing, new DNA testing that keeps evolving over time in different labs, and we're expected to keep up on it with our limited resources. That's the challenges that we face with the caseloads we have and the increasing technology that we're dealing with.
Mr. Chairman, the other one, obviously, we talked about a little bit, touched on, is computer forensics and cell phone forensics. Again, the same kinds of issues, something that, you know, even 10 years ago, I don't think any of us ever envisioned, and obviously some of the things you all have dealt with on the civil side. The two issues that we really have made life more complicated for all of us, frankly, but in particular public defenders that are in the system are clients with chemical dependency issues and mental health issues. The health department did a study a number of years ago, I think it was back in 2009 or 10, that 80 to 90% of all of Minnesota's criminal cases involve alcohol and drug abuse or addiction. I think if you talk to anybody that's involved in the criminal justice system, your judges, your probation officer, anybody, they will confirm that those statistics. Roughly, those folks with co-occurring substance abuse and mental health disorders, roughly probably 45 to 50% of those folks that are in our jails that have that. Mental health issues, 30 to 50% of our jail inmates suffer from some kind of mental illness. This has been a huge, huge factor. I know all of you who have been here for at least a couple of years have heard this in your various committees. And what we have done is, as we have deinstitutionalized folks, we haven't had an alternative for them, or many alternatives. And what ends up happening is these folks end up on the street, they end up in places, they get arrested, they get put in jail, and our jails aren't equipped to deal with this. Our sheriffs aren't equipped to deal with it. They're not mental health providers, but that ends up being kind of the default because we don't know what to do with them. And those are the folks, frankly, that keep coming back and are our reoccurring clients, because either they don't take their meds or they can't afford their meds, and then they end up in this vicious cycle. Another one that's been on the scene recently, and Mr. Chairman, I know you and Representative Scott have dealt with this issue quite a bit, is the use of body cams. Again, we're not here to argue what should be private, what should be public. We're not here to argue that's a good idea or a bad idea. We're talking about volume. If you heard before on a regular, on our felony case, when we're talking about 12 to 14 hours of work that somebody would be doing on that case, or 4 to 5 hours on a misdemeanor case, imagine when you get a call from our police, get a call, and now they have two or three squad cars that come, and you've got three or four body cameras or more to review. That will take up your time just in reviewing those. What happened? What happened? What did people say?
And if you want to use any of that evidence, you need to have a transcript for trial, et cetera, pay for that and go through the transcript as well.
But, Mr. Chairman, it's got to be reviewed, right?
And I do want to bring up at this point, and by the way, members, in light of Representative Considine's inquiry about questions, this is not the only time the public defenders will be in here. They'll be in here multiple more times, especially when they go through their budget specifically. This is just meant to be an overview, so there will be more opportunities. But I did want to bring up something that the committee may be seeing, and it's been an area that has stuck in my craw ever since we've had increasing levels of technology used for law enforcement. Representative Scott and I have dealt with this. It's that when you have body cam or a license plate reader or some kind of facially neutral way of collecting evidence, and when you have a police force that spends its time disproportionately in communities of color, you then end up with a much larger body of evidence examining the habits of a certain population. Everyone screws up from time to time, but if you're being investigated or looked at more, you're going to get prosecuted more or charged more. That is a disparate impact reality that I think we have to deal with, that I think is kind of unfair. Disparate impact constitutionally only applies to housing and employment at this time. However, based upon the increased use of technology, by no necessarily intent on part of the police to discriminate, it happens by operation of the technology and location of where they're at. So I don't know how we're going to deal with that, but it is something that I expect the committee will look at one way or the other. Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, the other issue to deal with this is just storage of all of it. I should say the transmission of it and storage of it. Obviously, you've got to have bigger data lines if we're getting this information either from the police or from the prosecutors. And then where do we store it? Because it becomes part of the client's file. I know other agencies have struggled with this. The police are struggling with it. There have been a number of police agencies across the country that quit using the body cameras or were reduced their use because of the tremendous storage cost of this. It's something we are struggling with right now. And frankly, we don't know exactly what we're going to be able to do with it. Right now we're burning it all to a disk and then putting it in with the client's files, but it's probably not the most efficient way that we can be handling it. We really don't have any other option right now. The use of drones, again, another issue, Mr. Chairman, I think goes along with what you just, your comments. I'm sure we're going to see more of that. The Bloomberg News reported there are 340 agencies that use these now. Again, I'm sure if the police will come in and tell you, it's a great tool to use. But again, it's one of those factors that we have to work with or deal with. Language and cultural barriers. We are becoming more diverse, and we are seeing that in our client base and dealing with more folks who English is not their first language, and just basic cultural things. These all take time to deal with. They all take time to for defenders and for our support staff to work with and to be proficient in. Federal, state, local funding decisions, particularly federal decisions. You can see here we've got a few examples of things like DWI enforcement, domestic violence enforcement, again, where there are federal grants. Again, we're not here to say they shouldn't be done. We're not here to say they're not good things, but they do add to the caseload. They do add to the workload, particularly when you start having full-time people doing this work that are either federally funded or locally funded. Not only do they add to the workload because they're driving more cases, but we don't have an ability to respond to that. You all budget on a two-year cycle here. So if, for example, Hennepin County, I'll just pick on them right now, is they decide January 1st to do something more in terms of domestic violence, for example, or if the feds come in October in their budget year and decide you're going to get federal funding, we don't have an ability to respond to that. And that's happened actually quite a few times. Other workload factors. In the private sector, we're getting more cameras. Target now has a state-of-the-art forensics lab that it uses and then shares this information with law enforcement and with the prosecutors. We were up in St. Cloud not long ago. I think I used this example one other time. We were in a coffee shop on Little St. Germain Street in downtown St. Cloud. They had 9 cameras in the coffee shop. So, again, if there was an incident that happened there, hopefully there wouldn't be, but if there was an incident and we had to now look at 9 different camera views or 9 different pieces of evidence from those cameras.
I know the Mr. Carr, are those cameras all still up from the RNC in 2008? All these cameras went up on all the light posts in 2008 during the RNC, and I think they're still there.
Well, Mr. Chair, from the Super Bowl last year, they were in downtown Minneapolis.
Even more, of course. Okay. So, thanks.
Mr. Chairman and members, which brings us to the collateral consequences. We touched on a little bit. Another one of those issues that our defenders have to deal with and are ethically obligated to deal with. We have 200 collateral sanctions in statute in Minnesota, not to mention the federal ones. And so these are all things that, as our lawyers are advising clients, they have to be up to speed on and advise them as to what might happen. Student loans, housing, you name it, right? Those are the things that our folks have to be up on. Those are the folks or the issues that they have to deal with. Changes in the court system. Those of you who are lawyers and have had to deal with the e-file and e-service, for the courts it has been a wonderful tool, I believe, for them to get rid of some of the paper, for them to deal with their cases. I will tell you, and I think most lawyers will tell you, for the practicing attorneys, it has become a time consumer. It's more work for our attorneys. It's more work for our support staff. I will tell you, I've told your previous committee, I've told our own staff, the most efficient thing for us and the easiest thing for our lawyers is paper. Because we can take the files, we can go into the jails with them. You can't go into the jails with a disk because it might be used as a weapon. We totally get that. We have trouble in some cases bringing in laptops. And even if we do, how are clients going to view that material? But we also understand that, that's not the direction that the system is going. But it has provided, it has increased the burden on our support staff and on our lawyers in terms of the paperwork, if you will, or the those kinds of issues that are not issues of practicing law. It just has. Lastly, Mr. Chairman, and we touched on it a little bit, and we want to just bring up some of the issues that you're going to hear about in the next few weeks, and this is more for the budget hearing, but we just wanted to bring it up. That number one, the child protection cases, we talked a little bit about that earlier. We have also seen a tremendous increase in the number of felony cases and gross misdemeanor cases over the last 3 years, so caseload growth is going to be an issue. Recruitment and retention of staff, we're dealing with as a number of agencies are, some real issues in recruitment and retention, particularly in greater Minnesota. And as I mentioned before, our cost-sharing arrangement with Hennepin County. So those are some of the things that we're going to be visiting with you all about as we come around over the next few weeks and obviously talk about in the budget hearing. With that, Mr. Chairman, can stand for any additional questions folks have? Or
that's an outstanding job getting through that quickly, so thank you. Representative Liebling, go ahead, Representative Liebling first.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for the presentation. I just wanted to ask, around everything legislators do now, we hear about workforce shortages everywhere, every industry, every group. And I know that public defenders, as you were just explaining, are overworked. I know they're underpaid. But I just wonder if you could give us a snapshot of the workforce issues in public defense. Like, is it a lot of them are part-time? I know that's been the case for many, many years. But, you know, just in terms of the availability of people to do the work, and I recognize that pay is always going to be a part of that. Can you just give us a snapshot of where we are
sure.
with that?
Mr. Kyer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, we're going to save that for our budget presentation, but we can do it very quickly here. Last year, we, in our assistant public defender staff, we had about 9% of our staff resign, about 8% the year before that. Now, that's just resignations. That's not folks who retired. That's not folks who were appointed to the bench. That's not folks who, didn't make probation or we terminated. That's just resignations. So we're turning over about 10 or 11% of our staff every year in the last couple of years. On the recruitment side, in the 5th District, which is that southwestern corner of the state, basically from Mankato west, the last three times we've gone out for an advertisement for an assistant public defender position, we got zero applications. The time before that, we got 5, and 4 of those folks were not qualified. The last application process we put out in the 8th District, which is Wilmer and that area, we had 2 applications, I believe it was. One was from a fellow in the Twin Cities who didn't have a car. How he was going to get out to Renville County, I'm not quite sure. But those are some of the issues that we're dealing with. By and large, we've done some survey work of our folks. By and large, people are leaving for 2 reasons. One is salary, and one is workload or the way they are treated in court. Those are the biggest factors.
And
they are going to other public agencies when they leave us.
There isn't a week in our office where I don't hear from a chief or a managing attorney where a staff member hasn't cried in the office based upon either how they're being treated or how they feel so unsupported or unprepared based upon the desire of the courts to push these cases through the court system. So the retention is a huge issue for us. I mean, we work very diligently at creating a safe environment, a positive environment, a working environment. But as Kevin said earlier about, we cannot stop the crushing caseloads. And so folks are looking to other government agencies or other private practitioners to find a job where the pressure simply isn't on them, that it is in our office day in, day out, month and month by year.
Members, we have Representative Scott, Mariani, and Moeller. If you want to be on the list, raise your hand. We have 9 minutes. Representative Noor. Also, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I get to my original question, what's the salary of a starting full-time public defender?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Scott, we starting pay just coming in the door from, let's say, from law school is $55,115.
Okay, thank you. And my next question, thank you, Mr. Chair, is regarding video appearances, and especially in these rural areas. Is that becoming more commonplace? Are those courthouses, are they equipped to do that? And can you find some financial savings by doing video appearances?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, we are more than willing to appear by video. I mean, it's been, for many years, we've been kind of the dumping ground that we've been reluctant to do ITV appearances, and that simply is not the case. The question becomes, can all the courthouses, do they have the facilities to set up these appearances? Please understand, though, we still have to meet with our clients. So we would still be traveling to see the clients, speak with them prior to the first appearance or to a Rule 5 or Rule 8. So we would still be making those travel arrangements anyhow.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Kyer and Mr. Ward, for being here today. And I just really have a comment, which is I'm an appellate prosecutor, and so most of the work I do is against the Appellate Public Defender's Office. And I just want to thank you for the excellent work that your staff does, and I appreciate the difficult task that we have. And even though it's an adversarial process and we have different opinions about the cases, I do really appreciate the hard work that your office does. So thank you.
Thank you. Kathy does wonderful work, yes.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My quick question is, do you have demographic breakdown of the cases that the public defenders represent?
Representative Noor, we do not. One of the concerns we've had, we've relied on the courts for the demographic breakdown, and too often it's folks who are not filling out the information or are not completing the information as far as their background. We've created an electronic case management system that the pilot has rolled out this past fall, and one of the things we are going to collect is demographic backgrounds, because it's been the information is something that's vitally important to us. We refer to it too often in motions, but we just don't have all the proper data to back up our allegations and our vermin in the motions. So we will be collecting it.
Thank you. Members, this is going to conclude our testimony for day. Today, the public defenders will be back. I just wanted to leave you with this closing comment. Keep in mind that depending on who you come through here and testify about, the defendants that come through the system, folks will estimate 70 to 90% have mental health issues, 60 to 80% have addiction issues, and I, as a private defense attorney, have the ability to decide who I'm going to take as a client. And let me tell you, I've taken some handfuls at clients, okay, those folks who can pay. If I choose not to take them because they're a giant pain in the rear associated with maybe their issues, they go to the public defender. And the public defender has a huge percentage of those folks, and they require an exceptional amount of hand-holding, and they take a substantial amount of abuse from them as well. And the defendant is getting it for free. And so keep in mind that that's the nature of the job, and it's a really tough job. And I've seen it firsthand in the court system for almost 20 years now. So I have tremendous respect for the talent level of the public defenders that we have in Minnesota. Thank you, gentlemen, for being in here and testifying. Other comments from the committee? Representative Considine?
Is it somebody's birthday today?
I don't think so. I haven't heard any notification of that. Thank you, members. Committee is adjourned.